Welcome back to our roundtable panel this morning. I'm Joe Donahue, along with our incredibly wonderful what's a great August?
August? Oh, wow. It is August.
It is August.
Yes.
Speak it's for yourself.
August.
Oh, same word. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. See what he did there?
Yeah.
Ray Graff is here. We've missed you, Ray. Good morning.
Hi.
Hey, good to have you here.
Ready for some radio magic.
Excellent. University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo joins us. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning. Great.
And, of course, last but certainly not least, WAMC's Alan Chardock.
No, I would just amend that to say last and certainly least.
No.
No. Good morning. And yeah, see what I did there.
Let's be August.
We have a...
Ooh, there's some wind coming through.
We have a lot to talk about today.
I know from where.
All right, take two. Start again.
We have a lot to talk about this morning, and we're going to, in the latter half, we'll talk about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. We'll be talking about that a lot this morning. Representative John Lewis will be on the show later on, talking about his speech and his life and career, and we'll be hearing... Alan's incredible power of words that he did with Carl McCall coming up at 11 o'clock where he recreates the I Have a Dream speech, which will be is an incredible piece of tape, and we will hear that this morning. Also a reminder coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon is NPR coverage of the commemoration of the March on Washington. We'll be covering that from 2 to 4 this afternoon. So a lot going on in that regard, but a lot of other things to talk about. I will say that as I was preparing last night for trying to get to articles to talk about, that it is difficult when both the Washington Post and the New York Times are down.
Yeah.
That's a great story in itself.
And so for several hours, certainly the New York Times, the Washington Post's blackout was much briefer, but the New York Times website was down for a better part of the day yesterday. I think it started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and when I went to bed last night at 11:30, it was still down. And it was there was an organization that has, I guess, I always find this weird, but taken credit for bringing the hacking into the site and taking them down. They have long been, the group is called the... the Syrian Electronic Army, and they have been involved in many of these attacks. This is certainly, this was the most severe. The New York Times called it a threatening attack and malicious. And it's very interesting of how a major news organization can basically be brought to its knees.
Yeah, it's a reminder. We spent all summer in the group I work with over in Eastern Europe working on computer security. We've known this was coming, but now it actually seems to be put into place that there are attacks and we're all vulnerable.
Well, I would think that's the last sentence is probably really so, in that the New York Times is not exactly a small operation.
Right. No.
And they have certainly known about this because it's happened, I believe, before.
Yes.
Sure, they're a prime target, though, also. Yeah. So
right.
You're going to get the smartest hackers are going to be aiming for a big target like the New York Times or the Washington Post.
Sure. The other thing that I thought was fascinating about the article or about the incident was that there was great concern about the emails that were going out, because in the past and in this time, passwords were also acquired, and all employees were ordered to be very very cautious in the emails that they sent
out.
That's
scary. Yeah.
And because they was assuming that all of that was being tracked and monitored because they had access to the passwords.
You know, we really ought to do a Vox Pop, Raymond, on
Suddenly, I think you're in a meeting.
Oh, it's miles away. Yes. Yeah. What was that?
We ought to do a Vox Pop on how to make your computers more secure, because and what ideas there are out there about, you know, how to do it.
The hackers are at least one to two steps ahead of those who are at the absolute paramount of security.
Right.
Because the New York Times, as you say, is not a small operation and not a cheaply run operation.
No.
And they were hacked.
Here's what I learned this summer is that if the hackers want to get you, they can.
Really?
You can secure your computer. The more money you spend, the more secure you make it. But if they are targeting you, which I'm sure the New York Times is a target,
well, absolutely,
they will get through.
And
it's that bad.
The New York Times, and I can't find the figure immediately in front of me, but talked about the millions of dollars that they had spent just over the past few months since the last time that they were hacked on beefing up security and coming up with a system that makes it seem like there's a 1 in trillion chance that you could get in, and they got in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that puts everybody back to the drawing board of exactly what you do.
Sure. And of course, we have been talking, Joe, Rosemary, Ray, we've been talking again and again and again about the transfer from paper to digital.
Right.
All newspapers are going that way. You have to. And now we see that there's a downside to that also.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. It's the same technology that made all this wondrous communication that we have now possible has a big weakness in it. We haven't shorn that up yet.
I think a bigger issue here is one of how wars will be fought in the future. In other words, who knows if it was really this Syrian electronic army or not.
Exactly.
You know,
could be somebody else.
Somebody, I think for the Times, said it's either them or someone trying very hard to be them. However, a war is coming for whatever extent it is. And so I think we'll see this more and more in every conflict. And maybe they tried to hack the Pentagon and couldn't get through this time. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, we'll slam the New York Times. We'll slam, you know, big news outlets. It's part of the equation now.
You know, you're right. We're looking at it, at least I am, like from the media point of view. How do you ensure your own credibility? The New York Times uses the Wiener excuse. You know, we didn't really put it in. We were hacked. That's not our story. So we're vulnerable. But you're right. This computer security goes to national security. It goes to lots of business. Business transactions are all done by computer now. So we're vulnerable in many ways. As a country.
Imagine what the Chinese could do in a conflict.
I wanted to bring that up because apparently one of the major things on the Obama-Chinese agenda when they met last time was the fact that the Chinese have been allegedly trying to crash all over through our security.
I'm sure we're doing the same thing.
Really? Do you think so?
Yeah, I do.
That
was sardonic.
Oh,
when it comes to the when it comes to the when it comes to the New York Times and their problems, several days ago when they were hacked, they said that it was just a technical problem. They didn't believe that they had been hacked. Now they have linked the two together. Which, yes, I found very interesting.
Yeah, I did not know that. That's really interesting.
So the Financial Times, the Washington Post, have also been a target from this group. The DNA, they say, the DNA of the attack seems to be very, very much the same. I think two things that I thought were curious was one, it was trying to get the news last night was difficult because the sites were off, although the Times did a pretty good job of putting the stories up on both Facebook and Twitter, although the characters were all weird. I don't know if anybody saw it, but if you went to the you take one system and you put it into another and the apostrophe comes into a weird garbled filled with that, but it was still the New York Times, and it looked very different and very pared down, and it looked very strange.
They used Comic Sans.
Yes.
They should have come out with an extra, put it on paper and hawked it on the street.
The good old days.
No, I don't think they
remember those days.
I'm not sure they can do that anymore, right? I don't think you can do that. And of course, Twitter has been attacked as well in this, and believed to be also part of this SEA attack. And I want to get back to something that you had mentioned about, you know, what of blaming it on, you know, how that story get there in the good old days of however many years ago, 10, 15 years ago, when your paper didn't arrive to you in the morning or you didn't get the news. It was usually mm-hmm. because the press had broken down or something like that, something very innocent.
Right.
And yet the paper was put out this morning, and most of the problems were for almost 12 hours yesterday of people not getting the news because we're now on that cycle.
That they come to depend on.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about Syria and talk about what is going on. We'll also talk about how it's affecting the stock market here in this country. We welcome your comments as always. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC comes from Mr. Rooter Plumbing, working to fix water leaks, sewer odors, old pipes, valves, toilets, sinks, sewer lines, water heaters, and septic systems, thehudsonvalley.mrrooter.com. The Sembrick, Bolton Landing, New York, presenting a Thomas Pandolfi piano recital, August 31st at 7:30 p.m., thesembrick.org. The New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, serving the public for over 30 years, nysba.org/lawyer-referral. And the Blue Marble, a world of gifts, Amherst, Massachusetts, featuring handcrafted jewelry from around the world, thebluemarble.biz.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. This morning we are discussing many issues, and one of them, of course, is Syria. It is the top story in the world right now as the world watches and waits for the headline in CNN today is "We all hear the drums of war," which is especially concerning on this 50th anniversary of the March on Washington in what was looking for ultimate peace. And so we talk about this issue, and as the U.S. and key allies agree that something ought to be done about the conflict in Syria, the question is what? The question is when? And meanwhile, there are several other questions. One is the impact on the stock market, which I'd like to get into, and the other one is this question of what is it about the chemical weapons? Why intervene now and not earlier in the civil war, when 100,000 people have died in the conflict, which has raged for more than 2 years? What does it take? Why did it take chemical weapons to be that one part that flicked the switch to say, all right, this is what is going to make us act?
Oh, okay, everybody's looking at me. I don't know. I think it's simply a line in the sand, and it's arbitrary. The United States has no particular problem with chemical weapons. Foreign Policy is running an amazing article right now out of CIA files that were in the National Archive showing that we knew and helped Iraq, Saddam Hussein use a gas and other weapons against his enemies when we were on his side and against Iran. So why? It's just completely arbitrary.
So when we talk about the carnage and we use it as a justification,
right?
How do we then say, okay, but we've turned our back on it over the past 2 years where 100,000 people have been slain?
Well, I mean, isn't this the same as the Tet Offensive in Vietnam? Why did we suddenly switch after that? It was like, oh, there was an offense. We had an action.
And not just us, by the way. The entire world.
Yeah. Every country, I guess, picks it's the line in the sand, and that's what we picked.
And the line in the sand in this case is related to the line in the sand in Iran. Because we say nuclear weapons are a line in the sand.
You're right.
So if you don't do something here, then you're one, two and a half, two and three quarters becomes right. When you're counting to three. So, but I, you know, I talked to Congressman Joe Courtney this morning, early for Congressional Corner. And you know, he just said the choices here are unacceptable. You know,
they're horrible.
They're horrible choices because you know, you mentioned Osama, and that's right. That's exactly right. We supported that guy.
Yeah, we went up. We were on the side, if you will, of the Syrian regime in that conflict because it served us. And okay, that's what foreign policy is, I guess.
And nobody can tell me that even though we're not after regime change, that if you help one side, it redounds to the other.
Right.
And on the other side are some terrible people.
Right. And we are getting closer and closer, it looks now. They're saying, to reports I read, correct me if you've seen elsewhere, but it could be as early as Thursday.
Yeah.
That's like tomorrow.
That's tomorrow.
And
it's almost today, really, over there, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In a column in The Atlantic, Dominic Tierney, who is a political science professor at Swarthmore College, says blowing your people up with high explosives is allowable, as is shooting them or torturing them. But woe betide the Syrian regime if it even thinks about using chemical weapons.
Right, that's your point.
Well, I think that's a little smarmy myself. You know, to say it, chemical weapons are terrible things. We saw them in World War I.
Right.
And, you know, it's almost an international convention that you shouldn't do it.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I mean, the president has called it a red line. 1,300 people are believed, women and children included, are believed to have died as a result of the chemical weapons used in Syria. But again, when you use those numbers against the 100,000 people who were killed through other means, it does bring up the point of, you know, what that line in the sand, that red line.
Well, it also makes you really wonder about what kind of involvement we have. Are we going to have troops on the ground when we know that chemical weapons are in play? That was one of the great worries about, I guess, both Gulf Wars.
You were shaking your head, Ray.
I don't think we'll have troops on the ground.
In other words, it'll be missiles.
And quickly. Mm-hmm. And wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. It'll be fast. Because one thing this president knows is when you get in a quagmire and you are in a long, prolonged engagement, nobody wins. And so I think France, Britain, U.S. will do whatever they're going to do as, quote, unquote, punishment.
And then get out.
And then get the heck out.
Well, and that's the thing of them. But then when do you put the mission accomplished sign?
You don't.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't.
Or surging. We got real interested in that, too. We didn't just learn in Afghanistan and in Iraq that you go in and make a punishing strike and get out. We went in there and got more in there than we ever wanted to be. And we're still paying for it. So do you think the lessons learned?
Well, you know, here's the problem. Iran, as Alan, you know, alluded to at the beginning, is the absolute wild card here, because they hit Israel, then you have the beginnings of World War III, and it's going to get ugly.
We're going to take a break. We'll leave it there for the moment and continue this conversation. We'll talk a little bit about the effect on the stock market when we come back. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to The Roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. We are talking about many issues and mostly dominated by our headlines dominated by Syria and the news coming out of Syria. We would love to hear from you as always. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Rosemary Armeo is here, Ray Graff, Alan Chartok, and of course, we welcome your thoughts as well. When the Dow opened, U.S. stocks little changed with it when the stock market opened, settling a little bit after a sell-off based on fears about Syria and quite a slump yesterday on Syria fears. And according to Money Magazine, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 fell more than 1%, while the NASDAQ dropped more than 2%. The sell-off accelerated as the day progressed and the markets finished near their lows of the day. Global markets also closed lower, bringing up a question that I think Ray has, which is a very good question.
Yes. How do they know? They say, you know, it went down on fears of Syria, sell-off on fears of Syria. All right. How do you know that?
You listen to the stock market reports virtually every day, they always know or say they know.
Okay, they blame something.
But how?
The
weather was cloudy. Sellers in a selling frenzy.
See, I have this feeling about intuition, and excuses. So that if they want to raise your gas prices, they raise them. And then they say it's based on the fact that even though the pipeline hasn't changed at all. What's
it
in
could.
The pipeline? Yeah.
Well, I could see oil prices that went up $3, a barrel yesterday. I can see that on fears of getting the oil out of there. That would seem to make some practical sense.
Yeah, but still, Ray, you raised the question, and you're quite right. You could see it. I could see it. You could see that the Syrian situation made people afraid. But unless you have polled every single person who has been in the stock market or at least a representative sample, you don't really know. You don't know any more about your thesis on the gas than you do about the stocks.
Well, I mean, the stock market is a whole lot about gambling. You make some illogical, reasonable assumptions, and then you put your money down based on that. So, and the analysts do the same thing. But this one, I agree, seems pretty easy to me. You have huge now instability in the Middle East. That means oil prices are going to be affected, or oil supply is going to be affected in some way. So this would
and
oil prices, hits all of your living costs. So it would affect the entire stock market. So we shoot you down, right? Sorry.
I asked a question. How could you shoot me down
That's
for asking
true.
A question?
Well, he's right, of course.
Exactly.
One of the things that, just to be clear, Russ Kosterich, who is the chief investment strategist for BlackRock, called the Middle East one of the most overlooked risks for investors, saying if issues escalate through the region and push oil prices significantly higher, the already fragile economic recovery could be compromised. He also said that the belief of Syria having an effect on the market came as while Syria was dominating the headlines, U.S. investors did get some good news about the housing market. Prices for homes in the nation's 20 largest cities in June rose 12.1% over last year, but not enough to settle the slump and the concerns by Wall Street investors.
I like how the analysts also look at Tiffany, like this completely worthless, useless luxury. So whether it's up or down is a way to figure out what's happening in the stock market. And it had been up, but now it's back even again.
Are you going to buy a diamond ring?
But you know,
I hadn't been planning it. Was that a question?
No, that was a rhetorical question. I was not asking a personal question, meaning that being an arbiter.
There's so much interdependence in this world right now that if something happens somewhere else, it's going to be like one of these old Rube Goldberg things, something, the marble goes down a thing and affects something else. And, we thought that it wasn't going to happen, that we always thought we were sort of an island, even before we got into the Second World War, and Roosevelt had to sort of nudge us and do all the rest of that. But 1929 comes along, before that, of course, and the whole world goes into the tank.
Right.
We,
2008.
What'd you say?
2008, it happened again.
Yes, 2008.
Reminding us how interconnected everything is.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will talk about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, what we have learned, what we have not learned, and much more. And we always welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Express Pediatrics Highland. Walk in urgent care for children 7 miles from New Paltz and open Monday through Friday from 5 p.m. to midnight. Weekends noon to midnight, expresspediatrics.com. Bethel Wood Center for the Arts, presenting American singer and songwriter Joan Osborne in concert Friday, September 13th at 8 p.m., bethelwoodcenter.org. And Handmade and More, New Paltz, offering a mix of American handcrafted and internationally made crafts and jewelry, plus toys, paper goods, and women's clothing and accessories, 845-255-6277.
Poker is Satan's game.
Welcome back.
Well, the microphones are now on, everyone.
Where is Satan's Cafe anyway, Ray?
Satan's Cafe?
Yeah. Is
there you go out, wrestler out before. And,
yeah.
It's not.
It's on. It's just past the lake.
Are you sure it's?
Oh, it could be.
Yeah, right. You never know. Yeah. All right. So the how did Joan Osborne come up during the break?
I don't know.
I asked. So they said that Joan Osborne was going to be appearing.
Was that the underwriting?
As an old fellow, I asked who she was.
Right, and we explained.
Great song. And then it became a thing.
Degenerated.
Tell our poor our listeners about this, because Ray said her song, If God Were One of Us, was going to have her singing at Satan's Cabaret.
Sure.
And then I said, you love poker, and that's Satan's game. And
right.
Yeah.
I think God loves it all.
Fair enough.
I
prefer the wrathful God approach as the...
And now, transition, let me talk about the March on Washington.
I remain unscathed in that conversation.
Now you're going to have to really be a professional and pull this back to you.
Dear WAMC.
All right. So three presidents, scores of stars, will gather at the Lincoln Memorial Wednesday. That is today, this afternoon, to close the commemorative ceremonies marking Martin Luther King's 1963 March on Washington. As I mentioned earlier, we'll be covering this live with NPR coverage from 2 to 4 this afternoon, 3 o'clock being, the time where Martin Luther King gave and delivered his I Have a Dream speech. And it is, as we said, it's been a week-long series of events and commemorations. We'll be talking to John Lewis coming up in about 15 minutes. It is really a time to reflect of where we are, where we were, where we've come, and what work we still have to do, and I think that's just part of what happens in something like this. Besides the obvious, which was, oh my God, that was only 50 years ago.
It feels so old. This was an amazing historic event I was alive for, and now it just feels so ancient, except for a project that I'm completely taken up with. And NPR has been doing it, so you may know about it, where a group has been live tweeting the march 50 years later. They're using newspaper and radio accounts to get information at the time, like one day before, 2 days before, an hour before the march begins. And then they're live tweeting it as if it were happened. So the millennials today, this is how we witness all news, are going through the march from 50 years ago. It's utterly fascinating. Time 50 years ago, a group of volunteers was making like 80,000 sandwiches because you had to feed all these people who are on the mall, and it just makes it all come back alive again. I think the media actually has been pretty interesting in this event.
The only thing I disagree with is that you said it so long ago. To me, it seems like yesterday.
Yeah, that's because we're old,
yesterday.
Though, Alan.
I was not. I was not yet born, but not by much.
It in.
But my point being is that we think of this as it just doesn't seem that long ago, it seems like recent history because we've all sort of lived through the aftermath and what has gone on after the march and after the Civil Rights Amendment and so forth. So it's interesting to see where we are and where we have come. And you do have to wonder of what we would say and how different the tone of an event like this would be if the featured speaker would not be the first African-American president of the United States.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's, of course, and it has been throughout Obama's reign. That's been such an interesting thing to watch, to compare him with Martin Luther King. Here's what it's made me think of. Number one is, could a march like that or a protest, would it have any effect today? We've seen huge masses of people come together to demand war, get out of Iraq, or don't start a war in Iraq, and it did nothing. Mm-hmm. Why did it work 50 years ago, and why is that?
Well, how do you know it didn't work? I mean, you got a president of the United States who was committed to getting out of Iraq. You're committed to getting out of Afghanistan. And how do you know those marches don't affect them?
Oh, I guess you're right. I guess commit to getting out doesn't mean surging and putting more people in.
But then he turned around and went the other way.
The biggest protests in the world at that time took place before the United States went into Iraq, and it was barely covered by the press, and it didn't have any effect on our going in. And yet this March on Washington was so moving and seen for such a momentous event that it that it did have echoes that went on to this day. And the second thing that affects me is Martin Luther King. I can't wait to hear your show on that speech. That is just a remarkable speech.
And NPR had Mahalia Jackson this morning, had the idea that she didn't like his, what he was doing, apparently, just a prepared speech, and yelled, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And so he puts down the speech, and he goes into this sort of Detroit Reverie. Thing that he had already done, and then does the call and response, basically,
right.
And that is so important.
So it's just an amazing performance and a presentation. I don't mean performing like fake. I mean what he did was so amazing. How come we don't have that anymore? Where's that going?
Right.
Even Barack Obama, who's a wonderful speaker,
I mean, good speaker.
doesn't put on, you know, that kind of just like searing. I keep using the word performance because I can't think of another
one. Well, I think that, that is a word. I mean, I think that is, it is.
It does have a connotation of you're just
it
faking
does,
it.
But,
I don't
but
mean
I think,
that.
But it is a, I mean, you're giving it everything you have and
right.
you are selling this, basically this message to, right.
and it
to
got,
a
it
crowd.
Came across. I mean, do you realize that?
Although I would only argue with you. I think when the President of the United States, during his speech right after being reelected this last time, when his speech in Philadelphia on civil rights, as well as his speech at Mile High Stadium in Denver, were times where I don't know if I would compare them to the content, but as far as having that gravitas, man, it was pretty good.
Hmm.
I mean, goosebump time.
Oh, that's great. I don't know. It's always a rare thing to have a great orator like that. I think Jesse Jackson. I've heard him when he was running, and it sends shivers down. And Barack Obama certainly
really?
Has that. Yeah,
see,
really.
I didn't think so. I mean, I think if you listen to the King's words, they are Mahalia Jackson may have yelled, "Give us the
tell
you
us
know,
about the dream.
Tell us
yeah.
about the dream." But it was so clear, so organized. It wasn't a traditional speech in that it was just off the cuff, and it was as if he had written it and was now doing it.
Right.
It was a superb thing. I never felt that with Jesse. Of course, I always felt Jesse Jackson was a good speaker. Mm-hmm. But I never felt that he reached me the way that King did.
Well, you know, and I think King was just a fabulous speaker. I think this went beyond, which can happen. You have a great
right.
speaker and he's moved, yeah. and how would you not be by
sure.
that setting? And he went above and beyond. I have to say that it is the biggest cliche in writing, certainly in journalistic writing now, to say, have a dream. And I have to warn students that unless you're writing about the March on Washington, have a dream. It's been taken. It's become like a Shakespearean saying. Mm. It's
right.
so it's so touched everything. It's become a cliche.
You know, you also think of when of that the speech being described by those around him and say Martin is now going to be taking you to church, and I think that's, I mean, obviously that's a large part of this, is that he was a preacher, and
exactly.
that was a really large part of this, is that yes, it was a speech, but it was also a sermon. I mean, no question about it.
Yeah, but to return to the Jesse Jackson question, he was
yeah,
also
he was too. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, it's, you know. Not a contest in that regard.
But no, it's not a contest. But there is so much truth to this speech, and it was delivered so clearly and so crisply that it was really outside the pantheon of of speakers of any color.
Yeah,
there was a when I was on vacation a week or so ago and was at the Lincoln Memorial, and you just stand there on that spot where he was, which is marked on the steps, mm-hmm. and you look out on the mall, and it's and of course the pictures are there, and there's a beautiful picture taken by a photographer who passed last year, whose name escapes me at the moment, behind the shoulder of Lincoln.
Statue.
Looking of the statue and looking down behind Martin Luther King and looking out at the people, which is
sure.
one of the most haunting things I've ever
no,
seen.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think the analogy between Lincoln and M.L. King is so good because they were both spiritual people.
Yeah. And as you said, you know, how could you not be moved by many people on the Mall of Washington going down from the Lincoln Memorial all the way down to the Capitol?
Right.
It's stunning.
And again, this NPR project, which is live tweeting the event as if it were happening today instead of 50 years ago, the mood of the people at the time was it was jubilant. It wasn't militant. It wasn't angry. It was like, this is the right time and place. It's just quite remarkable.
You know, I'll get into trouble for this, but so yesterday was your turn. Today's mine. but you know, when we were listening to this fellow on the King confidant and lawyer, do you remember his name, Joe? The guy who was talking about what we're going to go to church now.
Yes, I do. I can't think of his name, but yes.
Never mind. Well, one of the things he said, which was so interesting, was that RFK had signed the warrant to intercept all of King's messages, telephone messages. That's the same RFK who we've named a major bridge after, but the same RFK who thought that King was dangerous, and has said so. The same RFK who apparently got into a little altercation with Eleanor Roosevelt about, are you with us or, you know, aren't you? The same RFK who represented Joe McCarthy. The same RFK who did, and yet we have given him absolute free pass on history. We say, okay, but the thing about RFK is that he came around. That's the important thing, that sooner or later he came around. But, you know, there are other people, they make a single mistake in their lives and we never hear about it. They're done.
And how the stories that came out of how the White House was watching this event.
Absolutely brought him in after they saw this was going to be free of violence. The president reached out to them and brought them up to the White House, to the Oval Office, and it shook each and everybody's hand and talked to King about his dream. You know, this was really, these guys were master politicians and they were playing every nuance, every bounce of the ball.
So where are we 50 years later, and where do we look at in the future?
The only way to make this work, I've been thinking about this a lot, the only way to make this work is to have equality of opportunity, meaning everybody gets a first-rate education, means everybody has enough to eat, means everybody has enough to a place to live, and is free from danger and being shot. And once that happens, you'll see a massive change in the way that this whole thing goes. That's what has to happen. And King knew it. And that's why he was the most, quote, the most dangerous Negro in America, because he knew that if everybody had an equal chance, that the society would be healed.
Okay, well, here I'm going to get into trouble again, because I'm reading a book right now about Fidel Castro. And you know what? That's what he promised Cubans after his revolution. Equal opportunity at education and health and food and a place
Let's
to live.
Let's see if I get this straight now, Rosemary.
Fidel Castro. Let
me see if I have this. Get this straight. So you're saying, I hope I don't get this wrong, you're saying that what King said, which is who I was just talking about, and what Castro said, so that if King got to be got into power, he would have put people against trees and shot them, like Castro did.
No, I don't really think I said that. Well, I'm pretty sure I didn't say that.
Perhaps leading the witness.
Yeah, we're going to have to run the tape back, but I think there may be some leading of the witness.
Well, no, but you said...
The ideals of the Cuban Revolution are the same. And I guess what I'm saying is that the form of government doesn't matter. Not Egypt, not Syria, not the United States. There are basic common things that everybody needs.
No, that's true. But you said, and maybe everybody has jumped on me and criticized me, which I resent more than I can tell you. But I am. But I'm. But I am not sure that you weren't saying that Fidel said all of the things that we wanted to hear about equality and equality of opportunity, and then turned out to be a guy who killed his enemies. You said it in the context of the ML King discussion. That's what got me a little
wow.
bit.
Wow, you're like Hamilton Berger this morning. You are the
Hamilton
prosecutor.
Berger, as you know, always lost.
Well, I don't think you're going to win this one.
Why not?
Because that's not what she said.
It is. Well, okay, then that's enough.
Yeah, I think on this day of
reconciliation,
of commemoration, and of peace and activism, we'll leave on that note.
Wow.
Good. And I'll meet you out in the parking lot.
All right. We
all take care of that, that little comment.
All right. Well done.
You can join us roundtable at WAMC.org. If you want to let me know, I can give you individual email addresses. roundtable.
Apparently, everybody already knows mine.
Yeah, I think they already know yours. Roundtable at WAMC.org. More show coming up after this.